Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren Dion-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are back to, as part of our countdown to our final episodes here, we are again in our various places. Radha and I tried to be in the same place this weekend.
We did.
And it was a massive COVID fail. We don't need to go into it, but it was a little sad. And I spent a lot of time on the highway on Friday, so.
It was just a very 2020 experience.
It was extremely 2020. I spent
like this thing. I like that we keep it consistent.
4 hours in the rain on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. It's not how I was expecting to spend my day off. Ladies, what are we drinking this morning?
I'm drinking coffee. It has not been microwaved yet. Give it some time.
Yet.
A little bit of Frangelico in there because it's already been a bit of a morning. It is gross here in Washington, D.C. It's cold. It's rainy. It's the day after Halloween and it's daylight savings. So
yeah. Similarly, I'm drinking coffee, but it has been reheated and I prefer not to say how many times. but I did pour a literally arbitrary whiskey. Like I can't even tell you which one that I picked up on my way past the bar to come up. We have a bar room that has a bunch of our whiskey on it. And so that's what I'm drinking. Reheated coffee with arbitrary whiskey.
Erin,
but daylight saving with kids is terrible.
Erin, are you drinking LaCroix perhaps?
I am not, actually. I'm drinking my second wave of coffee, also not microwaved. But I realize I'm utterly lacking in Bailey's or Kahlua or Godiva liqueur, which is also very nice in these situations. So
great.
I need to get my winter booze game up and going. I've really been more committed to the martini situation, which it turns out is just a glass of very cold alcohol. And I don't know why I didn't know that before, but it turns out they're delicious. But I'm not drinking martini this morning. You can't remix them. Keep them in the freezer. I'm just drinking regular coffee. So with that, shall we? We have two fabulous guests joining us this morning. And I think they're very apt as we continue our countdown to our final episode. We have back with us again, Corey Shockey, who is our most frequently invited guest. I believe this is her fourth appearance. And that means that she's the winner. She's always a winner in our hearts. Corey Shockey leads the foreign and defense team at AEI. Hi, Corey.
Hello, my friends. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be on one of the final podcasts to thank you for all you have contributed to the field and to my education with this outstanding undertaking.
And thank you for being such a fabulous guest and loyal supporter over these last few years. On the flip side, we have a brand new guest, Katrina Mulligan. Katrina is the Managing Director for National Security International Policy at the Center for American Progress, or CAP. And this is Katrina's first time with us, but she's a longtime follower and fan. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, and I am fangirling about being on the pod today.
But first, the bombshell questions. So we're going to do an abridged version of this. We've decided that the climate change travel question is just too big of a bummer, even for us, even in 2020. So we're going to stick to the other three. So let's start with, if you had a robot in your house, what would that robot do? Katrina, we'll start with you.
All right. So I've been thinking about this question a lot just because I've listened to a lot of other people's answers to it on the pod. I used to watch the Jetsons growing up, and the robot that I most want is the one where you get on a conveyor belt and you go through it in the morning and it does your hair and makeup and gets you dressed.
I think that's outstanding. I don't understand why we don't have that yet.
it's a real failure of the future, to be honest.
Corey.
Okay. I love Katrina's answers so much. I feel like I can hear Elon Musk in the background saying, we wanted these conveyor belts and all we got was 140 characters. What I would have a robot do in my house is sit in front of my computer for all of the Zoom calls I am now stuck doing that don't have the joy of in-person engagement, but do have the requirements of it.
You know, that's a new answer. I don't think we've heard that one yet.
What's even better about Corey saying this is right now, at this moment, Corey has her icon instead of video up, and it took me a good 5 minutes to realize that I just thought it was Corey smiling. Okay, so let's do next question. What book would you just like to live in for forever? Katrina?
All right, I'm going to go in a slightly different direction with this one than a lot, because I always feel like people answer this question in a very erudite way with like some book that shows how learned they are. And I have to say that my answer is the Berenstain Bears. And the reason, so I have a six-year-old, so this is the type of book that's frequently being read in my household. But there's a couple reasons why I would want to be in that. One is because I grew up in a housing project, and the Berenstain Bears books have such a different, I don't know, it's not the environment, the parental environment that I grew up with, and I really feel like it's very healthy and calm. Another reason is because those books have stood the test of time, and any parent can tell you if you read some of the older books that you grew up with as a child, a lot of the things in them are just absolutely jarring when you read them in today's world. And I would put like Nancy Drew's in that category, but the Berenstain Bears like has really stood the test of time. And there are very few things that really rub me the wrong way in a modern context. And another reason that's relevant to this podcast is actually because the Berenstain Bears don't have foreign policy. They don't need it. And there's something really quaint and adorable about that. So,
all right, Corey, how about you?
Well, mine is the 1886 travel book, A Lady's Life in the Rocky Mountains, written by Isabella Bird, who was a great adventurer and came to the American West and lived in Estes Park and describes mountaineering and the characters of the American West in the 1880s, and it's really wonderful. Let me just give you the phrase that I always think of that she says. She describes someone as having the most singular conversational dexterity. And the whole book is full of those kinds of wonderful descriptions.
That sounds fantastic. All right. What, I guess our last question here for you both is, what skill do you or hobby do you wish you had? This is tough for Corey because Corey actually has lots of skills that may not be readily apparent to the national security foreign policy crowd. Corey, do you want to take a first stab at this one?
Thank you for that beautiful compliment. I hope to be deserving of it. The skill I wish I had, or the superpower I wish I had that I do not, is to, as people begin to have heated arguments, especially about politics, I wish I had the power to reduce their body temperature slowly so that they get colder as they become more vituperative. And I feel like that would be good for our country.
Oh man, I wish everyone
also want
that
you to
skill.
Have that power.
That is awesome. Mine is so much less interesting than that. Mine is just, I wish I could sleep on planes. I can't sleep on planes. And the fact
I think
that
that's a great answer.
It's the worst.
Me too.
Because people who can sleep on planes are just more productive people. They arrive in a place, they're fresh, they're whatever. I arrive in a place and I look like I've stuck my finger in a light socket. I'm exhausted. And, you know, as a foreign policy professional, sleeping on planes is highly valuable skill. Or at least it used to be pre-COVID.
Plus, if you had your robot, you could sleep on the plane and have your hair done. You'd be like set. I mean, it all hangs together here.
There is a common theme about having my hair done that pervades all of my answers.
I really feel that in the lead up, we were chatting about how my hair is neatly twisted. And it's because, of course, I can't get haircuts. And I just have a truly tremendous amount of hair. And I have invested in trying to like twist and braid it into submission over this COVID period. So I too would buy your robot and do your hair.
But yours looks fantastic, Radha.
Thank you. That's what I come here for, really. Hair compliments.
That's right. Affirmations. Morning affirmations about why it's okay to drink before noon, why all of our hair looks great, even though we may have cut it ourselves, as Lauren and I have both been wont to do, all of the things. Okay, well, to move a little bit to the topics at hand, this episode will air on Election Day. I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a presidential and a series of other elections coming up 48 hours from now. It is Sunday. We know nothing other than millions of Americans have actually already voted, which is fantastic and good for democracy. And we are sort of waiting here on tenterhooks to see what the outcome will be. So we thought what we might do is have sort of a set of conversations around what are the kinds of challenges, what are the kinds of things that any next administration, whether it's the second term of a Trump administration or potentially a new Biden administration, what are the things that these people, these professionals are going to need to focus on or to address from a foreign policy or national security perspective? So we'll talk a little bit, I think, in more detail, but maybe we can start just with, you know, kind of a top level view of, you know, what should be in the mind's eye, one or two things that should be in the mind's eye very quickly in 2021 for either of these potential presidents. We'll start with Corey.
Okay. I would say, given the amount of the number of things that a Biden administration would have to set right again, make stable again, that there may be a temptation to assume that the Trump administration got everything wrong. And it's true that the list of things they got right is quite a short one. You know, of the three or four on the list I made for myself, recalibrating rates in the International Postal Treaty was one of the things on my positive list.
Good. It's important to make sure you get the full tally.
But one thing they do have partly right is increased attention on managing a rising China. And either a Trump or a Biden administration will need to have a better, less internally contradictory strategy for achieving that than the Trump administration has. And I think a less militarized strategy for achieving that.
I actually really agree. And so I think this is sort of I think both of the things that I had sort of identified are quite similar in a way. So I completely agree that caring about great power competition and trying to get our heads around what the future of that is going to look like is going to be important and is something that shouldn't be thrown out with the bathwater if a Biden administration is to take over. Because I think while I disagree with a lot of the mechanisms and sort of methods behind the way that the Trump administration has approached the problem, the fact that they've elevated the problem, I agree with. And the second, my second answer, which kind of relates to something that Corey said as well, is the use of economic tools in our foreign policy. And again, this is an area where I actually think Trump's got it wrong in a lot of areas and has overused certain tools like sanctions and tariffs. But the idea, the sort of foundational idea that we're going to need to start investing a lot more heavily or continue investing heavily in the use of our economic policy tools in our foreign policy is something that I think is probably correct and is going to need to continue in a Biden administration or in a future Trump administration.
It's funny, so that obviously would not surprise anyone, was sort of on my list of things to sort of talk about as we think forward. But what I think is really interesting and maybe like also worth sort of further reflection is this overlapping Venn diagram of sort of economic policy and economic partnerships and economic competition and other national security related, especially defense and military competition, and how we think about that ecosystem feels like something that we could spend more time thinking about. And I don't know that I know I don't agree with where the Trump administration landed on this, but I don't think that actually they're just wrong in a different direction than other past administrations, right? I think there's a lot of sort of missing opportunities on how we could better integrate or leverage trade-offs between those tools that I don't think we took into account. And I wonder kind of, as you guys look forward, if you have thoughts on things like that, like things that had been overlooked in the past that we should either not overlook or relook as we go forward.
So, I mean, one thing that I've thought a lot about is that I think have been overlooked is the way that we tie our foreign policy objectives back to the interests and needs of the American people is an area that I think, you know, is often overlooked. And I think what the Trump administration really did is they took that in a direction that I disagree, will not surprise anyone, I disagree with on the policy of this idea of America first foreign policy. But I think there's a thread in there, just tying back to the first question you asked, that is worth really thinking about and keeping. The reason that resonated so much with people is because they understood it as a means to advance objectives that are in America's interest and a way of thinking about foreign policy that people can feel like is doing something for them as opposed to for other people or something that they just don't understand at all. And I think that it's often, it not only is it overlooked, but foreign policy more than in a lot of other areas of domestic policy and other, you know, in other areas, is a place where we in Washington don't tend to understand or care very much about where the American people are on a thing when we pursue foreign policy. And so I actually think that it's not just explaining it better, it's also aligning it more closely to what the American people want. And, you know, the Center for American Progress a year and a half ago did a really interesting polling project of American attitudes on foreign policy in a report called America Adrift. And the findings were really quite important and I think have a lot of consequences for our foreign policy in the future, particularly along generational divides. And, you know, it is the case that younger voters are they are less interested in traditional military engagement, and they favor global action on things like climate change, human rights, basic living standards for all people. But one of the things I think is really important to think about is why there are these generational divides. And one of the reasons for that is because people under the age of 50 have grown up in a world where they haven't actually seen the consequences of foreign policy in the same way that older generations did. And I think that we are going to have to, I think, address that and make it clearer to people, hopefully in the absence of a cataclysmic emergency of global competition, why they should care about the way that we engage in the world. So I'll stop there. I'm interested in Corey's answer to this question as well, but you know, aligning our foreign policy with the needs and wants of the American people is probably, that's my answer.
So I agree in part with Katrina's thinking on this, but I'm more inclined to consider public attitudes on these issues malleable and volatile. And so the part I agree with is that younger people, because they have a different experience of the world, have different attitudes. When Jim Mattis and I did the public attitude survey, for our book, Warriors and Citizens, the most striking fact in the data was that people under the age of 25 had attitudes most similar to people who lived through World War II and the Great Depression. And it took us a while to figure out that, of course, their life experience of coming of age after September 11th, where they feel the security issues around them, and second, coming of age after the 2008 financial crisis, made them feel the economy is fundamentally not going to deliver for them. And so they're much more safety conscious in a lot of ways. And you know, not surprisingly. So they're likely to be bigger savers. They're likely to be more worried about employment and a social safety net than people who actually had the benefits of much more security. The part I differ with is that if you look at public attitudes during the time that President Trump has been in office, you actually do see enormous shifts. So if we're going to base our policy on following public attitudes rather than leading it, shaping how people think about it. So just to take one example, Katrina's right that President Trump, candidate Trump, was genius at asking first order questions, right? Isn't trade bad for us? Aren't immigrants taking our jobs? Shouldn't allies do more? But what you have seen in polls of public attitudes, like at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, is that people agreed with the question. And when they saw the president's policies, you saw more than a 15-point swing away from support for that. So raising the question is the part that I agree with Katrina, that the public has questions gnawing at them. But that's not an excuse for doing what people who don't spend all of their time thinking carefully about how to do this well might come up with. That's our job as people who work on these issues, to make the case, to connect the case to people's individual lives and interests, and to find good solutions that create structural and, here you go, Lauren, processes that advantage good answers and make them stable.
So I think that is a very thoughtful reaction, but I would push back a little bit on the idea that it is really only those of us who live and sort of marinate in this world that have, you know, the best and most thoughtful, you know, answers to these problems. I think, you know, when it comes to domestic policy, my impression, I've never worked in the domestic policy space, but my impression is that where public opinion is on things weighs more heavily in the way that they develop solutions and think about problems than it does in our world. And I think that's actually to national security detriment. I look at things like, you know, in our study, we in CAPS public opinion research, we found that voters across generational and partisan lines strongly desire more domestic investment in infrastructure, healthcare, education to increase our global competitiveness instead of merely increasing military and defense spending, for example. And I think, while I think that Corey is right that that often public opinion can swing dramatically, it tends to do so along party lines when people are in power. But when you look for those trends that defy generational and partisan lines, I think you actually can find some things that are quite important and that we should be paying attention to. And this is a great example of it, because I think we should be investing more at home in order to be strong abroad. And I think that if we listened more to that type of opinion and we allowed it to, and we wrestled with it when the conventional wisdom was out of sync with where the public was, and we wrestled with it more, I think we would actually come up with better answers.
I think one feature of this is also most of us here are creatures one way or the other of the executive branch. Where foreign policy and national security defense questions can sort of run, they can run amok, but they can run without as much congressional oversight, management, interference, and whatnot. And the domestic agencies certainly have typically more engagement with their congressional side and a lot of leadership on the congressional side in a way that's sometimes challenged in our communities. We could spend the entire time on this topic. I'm so glad you guys brought this up. I think it's fascinating and something that really has been highlighted by the last 4 years. But what's the daylight between the quote unquote Washington consensus to the degree that there was one? And I think there was for on a handful of issues and where the kind of default American public thought process and preferences lie. I want to shift gears just a little bit. So Radha asked, you know, kind of what have we overlooked that we should focus on? I want to ask the flip side of that. What are the sets of foreign policy problems? Maybe you would call them distractions, but they are, you know, well-known challenges that we could probably afford to spend a little less time on than we usually do.
I think we spend too much time thinking about the Iranian and North Korean nuclear weapons programs.
Oh, tell us more, Corey.
Because while non-proliferation policies that focus on preventing states from getting the means of producing nuclear weapons are extremely important and effective, and American security guarantees are hugely important in preventing proliferation, our policies that focus on ramping up threats of military force against threshold possessor states, I think, are not only ineffectual, as the cases of North Korea and Iran prove, but they are actually decreasing our security by emphasizing the political value of crossing the nuclear threshold while simultaneously making implausible claims of preventative military action. I think we would be much better served to, instead of, you know, so, as in the Obama administration, solely focusing on Iran's nuclear challenge, or as in the Trump administration, threatening a bloody nose preemption against the North Korean one, to emphasize, to double down on the strength of the security guarantees and emphasize that no matter what kind of weapons our adversaries have, we will protect ourselves and protect our allies, and no leadership that initiates a war and uses the or uses these weapons will survive the American and allied defense of our publics.
Yeah, that's a fantastic and interesting answer.
Yeah, it really is. Part of why I don't disagree, but another way of saying, in some ways, what Corey said is to lean in on the diplomacy side and move away from just, you know, trying to make it about military might. I mean, I do think that baked into your answer is the military might piece is in there, but I do think that we probably rely too much on, you know, the carrot and stick equation. I think we probably have a little bit wrong. But I would actually go in a more obvious direction, which is terrorism. You know, I think we have a serious problem of countering violent white supremacy at home, which people often refer to as domestic terrorism. And I do think that will continue to be an issue. But even notwithstanding that, the rise of violence in that domain, I feel like we have, over the last 20 years, focused on countering foreign-inspired terrorism to the exclusion of other things that have turned out to be a lot more foreseeable and a lot more deadly and costly to the American people. And by that, I mean, you know, the pandemic that we're living through right now, you know, wildfires, hurricanes. I mean, we have, those are all things that have affected our homeland. And while they're not man-made, the consequences have been far more severe. And yet we invest a lot less in the tools and abilities that we develop to respond to them. And so I when I look at terrorism and the entire, you know, Department of Homeland Security enterprise and then, you know, National Counterterrorism Center and some of the other ways in which we have focused on terrorism over the last 20 years, I think there's a real question about whether we are overdue for a strategic pivot.
Before I go to the next question, I will tease Katrina a little bit by saying that while I totally agree with her, and there's some really excellent writing over the past year or so on this exact topic in the progressive side of the Democratic Party, it also counters her messaging earlier about paying attention to the polls and the interest of the American people, because for all that the American people are rather tired in most polling of our intervention in Afghanistan and Iraq in particular, if you look at the Chicago Council and Pew and other polls, they are almost always putting terrorism up at the top of their list as things that they are super worried about. So it is a challenge for those of us in the national security field to think through, how do we address that after having so many years of we ourselves putting it up at the top in terms of our own investments, in terms of our time and people are starting a security apparatus and so on.
You are so right about that. You are so right about that. And it is a chicken and egg problem, right? Like, do they rate it as highly as they do because that's what we have been focused on for the last 20 years? Or, you know, what's the relationship between the two? It's a fascinating question.
But I would point out, Katrina, that you are contradicting your earlier view that the American public's attitudes should be followed on stuff.
So I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that in every case, the American, you know, we should be following. But I think that we should be wrestling more with the attitudes of the American people as we develop our policies. And it doesn't mean that every time public opinion swings, our foreign policy should swing along with it. But disregarding it as irrelevant to our foreign policy is, I think, a mistake.
Or I think just to frame it slightly differently, and then maybe Lauren can, I'm sorry to interrupt her upcoming question, is I think there's an open question about how accountable foreign policy should be to our, to the general public. And I think historically we have treated it as not accountable, as essentially an elite decision-making process because of the limited information and complex processes and established world order. And I think that does, that probably has been reset a little bit. And there's a question of how, what makes, how far to go along that accountability question to do it.
Yeah, I think just to close out that conversation before I go to this last question, in the typical situation room conversations, there is, when people talk about national interest, it is quite often separate from, to your point, Katrina, about individual American interests, where American citizens perceive their interests to be. It's as though there's a national security apparatus interest and there's the interest of the American people. And if we get too much talking about the interest of the American people, we're getting a little too close into politics. And there's a great discomfort amongst the national security crowd in engaging in political conversations. But merging those two, as you're, I think, trying to do, both of you are trying to do in your conversation, is it an uncomfortable challenge and also just an actually practically difficult one. Okay, so last question in this fabulous conversation. So there's a lot of things that both presidential candidates say that we absolutely need to prioritize and we need to get right. What is something that we really do have to get right in this next administration in terms of foreign policy, or we have either done something terribly wrong or maybe perhaps have lost our chance in some way? Corey?
Mine is an unoriginal conservative answer, but I also still think important, which is we need to come up with a plan for managing our debt. In the year of our Lord 2024, debt service is going to surpass defense spending as an element of the US federal budget. And I'm not arguing against coronavirus stimulus, either past or future. We obviously need to take care of American families, keep businesses running, and defibrillate our economy. But we also need to think about how to make our federal spending sustainable. And unless we do that, you know, our children's generation are going to be confronted with much starker choices than we would be. We need to just gently figure out how to pay for what we want, and over time, bring our debt down, and either by decreasing the numerator or increasing the denominator of debt to GDP ratio.
I've got a gentle plan for you, Corey. It's called taxes. And you could like raise them. It's incredible. I'm not an economist. I'm going to talk. Well, Rod, weigh in on that. But that is my gentle plan for paying for all the stuff we want. Anyway.
Numerator and denominator. Exactly.
That's right.
I mean, my answer, you know, it relates. I think there's some truthiness to what Corey said, but I would also point out that it's a rather there's a rather uncomfortable reality about, you know, that I think conservatives are going to begin to care a lot about the debt as soon as a Democrat takes over, if that's indeed what happens on Tuesday. And I think there's going to be a great amount of frustration on the left with the apparent hypocrisy of caring about that all of a sudden after the 4 years that we just had and the decisions that were made that really run counter to that. Although I respect that a great many conservatives felt uncomfortable as those things were happening. What I would say is that in order to get there, as part of that discussion, you know, defense spending has to be on the table, and in a way that it really hasn't been in the past. And I think there's a way to do that without suggesting that we become, you know, soft on defense, or that we eviscerate our military, or undermine our ability to our preparedness and military readiness. I think you can do it by actually, you know, doing a thing that we've been talking about for 20 years and haven't really done, which is rebalancing our defense and diplomacy in a way that actually leans further in on the diplomatic side, and maybe gets us out of the business of using military force as a tool of first resort. And I think that's something that would be a lot more cost effective than the way we do things today. But I also think privileging democracies in our foreign policy is another area where we really have to get that right. We have, in the last 4 years, really undermined our democratic partners and allies in ways that I think have consequences for our ability to lock arms with each other and deal with the global governance problems that are coming our way. And I think we've got to get that right, because, you know, if we're looking at the window we have to actually take a stand against China and really, you know, prevent some of the governance issues that we see coming our way, we're going to need to do it quickly, and we're going to need to do it. We can't do it alone. And so I think we're going to need to repair that damage pretty quickly. And it should be a first order priority for a Biden administration if he takes office.
Ladies,
thank you both for fabulous answers.
This has been so delightful to have you both on. I'm so glad that as we count down to our final episodes for Bombshell, that we got to have both of you on at the same time. I do wish it could have been in person with lots more champagne and tiaras and so forth, but we'll do that in the future.
Thank you, my friends, for the opportunity to be on Bombshell, not just this time, but so many times. Thank you for your contributions to the community in having created this magnificent cast.
Yes, and I completely echo those comments. Couldn't agree more. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to debate an esteemed colleague like Corey Shockey about these issues. The fact that there are so many brilliant minds wrestling with these problems is actually one of the things that gives me a tremendous amount of hope, no matter the outcome of the 2020 election.
Thanks, ladies. Okay, so instead of continuing into White House mayhem or keeping up foreign relations, I think, you know, that was such a fabulous conversation that we didn't get to participate in ourselves. We're a little jealous at this point. We, you know, didn't, there was fabulous discussion between the two. And I don't think did you guys mean for that to be a debate? I did not set that up as
a
debate.
No, but it was great.
But they had such great back and forth. So that was fantastic. Maybe, you know, Rada, Lauren, are there topics that you expected would come up or pieces that you wanted to interject in that you thought were most pressing?
So for me, the one thing that we didn't talk about that I think is worth just reminding ourselves is that immigration is both a foreign policy topic and a domestic policy topic, and obviously has been a huge issue this administration on a number of different fronts. And probably depending on the results of the election, we have an opportunity here to think really critically about a reset. And I think, you know, hearkening to some of Katrina's points on sort of accountability and understanding the American viewpoints here, I think there's a lot of nuance here, right? And there's a lot of ways in which the weird boundary between the way we make foreign and domestic policy really shows the seam on the issue of immigration. And we probably need to think about it. So like, up top in my mind in this category is obviously how we think about border control and sort of like threat issues around the border, where we want to be mindful of those threats and the risk of a porous border, but we like don't want to put children in cages to deter legitimate immigration discussions. That's like one. Two, how do we want to think about immigration in our armed services and in the military and in our more generally in our foreign policy apparatus? We've really had a hard pivot during this administration. If there is a change in administration, or as we look sort of forward and want to think about those issues, like how do we go about resetting and rebuilding trust in those communities? And the third is like, how do we want to think about trade, right? And trade and immigration are sort of intimately tied, and we're seeing that play out right now in the Brexit issues on freedom of movement in the population and the trade issues that go with them. We haven't really grappled with these issues in a long time in any satisfactory way, and certainly not in an integrated way. And that's, I think, to put a silver lining on it, we have an opportunity for a reset here.
Potentially. Lauren, what are you, what struck you from that conversation, either as a point you weren't expecting or something that you would like to see highlighted further?
I loved the first question about the foreign policy approach that could continue, because this is something that is true of every transition, no matter what, where you really just want to get rid of everything the last guy did. There are two things that there's actually several things the Trump administration has initiated or begun to pursue that I would want to see, if not necessarily preserved, then not discarded outright, or at least the homework built off of in a bit. And one is, they have done significantly more around technology policy as related to national security. They haven't done it always very well, but they have elevated it in a way that the Obama administration, maybe just by dint of the fact that it just was not at the right moment for that, but they've elevated it to a point that I think is worth studying a bit, both in terms of their sort of odd approach on 5G, on semiconductors, on spectrum. I don't think that they have gotten the answers right necessarily, but they have attempted to create processes, policy, and a community of interest around it in a way that the Obama administration either was not at a point where they were ready to, or just simply did not do altogether. The other thing I would mention, this is less a foreign policy specific thing, and this actually counters how the Trump administration actually makes their decision. They've done a lot on using data for decision-making, data and evidence-based policy making, partly as a result of Congress passing the Evidence Act a couple of years ago, but also they developed a federal data strategy that is attempting to build better data infrastructure and acumen amongst the federal workforce. A lot of that has frankly been driven by the career workforce and not by the political agencies, but they've allowed them to do so. And I think in any future administration, they've done a lot of the homework has been done to build off of that, despite the fact that the Trump administration itself has not necessarily always paid attention to that data for decision making. What about you?
Those are both very interesting points. I mean, I'm with you, and I think, you know, a variation on Radha's point on trade as well on the really this question of kind of how do you do major power competition under conditions of interdependence? And so that comes back to Huawei debates that we've had previously, some of the 5G questions, some of the other national security technology things. And I think you're right that a part of that table has been set in this administration. I just don't like the meal they've served. I mean, is that like the way to frame it, you know? I think that that's a piece that needs to continue. And I think we have, Hal Brands had a piece this week on sort of, you know, what things that the administration has done right. And, you know, he's, I think, a little overly laudatory about creating space for hawks on China policy. But I do think there has been a reset away from engagement, you know, cures all. And so now there is a sort of, at least, I think there's an appetite, you know, whether there should be a wishfulness for confrontation is probably where I would draw the line. But that's an interesting place, especially around that, as I think Katrina was discussing, kind of economic statecraft. And I'm really interested to see if that continues with the Trump administration or if that gets, you know, adjusted or not in a potential Biden administration. The one thing that didn't come up at all that I think is would have been my answer to the what do we really have to get right piece is something related to climate. I think that we are, talking about data-driven decision-making, the data on climate are really bad. I am not a climate expert either on the science or on the policy responses. But I think that this is something that, you know, the clock is, we're in the exponential piece of the warming. And we have, I think, a increasingly short window to make some major adjustments. So I have no idea what that's going to look like, but I have every expectation that it will be a foreign policy, if not national security issue here very shortly.
On the, what is always focused on that we should put on the back burner is not exactly what I want to get
at. No one likes to put things on the back burner. No one wants to highlight that.
So here's the thing, and this, I think I'm echoing and agreeing points that you made in our last conversation and also before. I mean, arms control is not something that we're like, it's not hard. Well, I don't want to say it's not hard. It's sometimes hard in execution, but it's not hard in objectives. We know generally what we would like to do. And so does everybody who comes to the table knows generally what they would like to do. Actually executing it is difficult. What I would like to see is to not have, so senior leader time to me is something that should be divvied out very, very, very carefully. We don't need as much senior leader time devoted to arms control. We should be able to execute arms control and arms control policy negotiation without it dominating the principles of the national security calendar, because if they are good in giving out their upfront guidance and they're good in getting out with their negotiating tactics and otherwise would be, we should not have to spend 2/3 of our year talking about arms control at a very senior level. I'm not saying that they shouldn't do it ever, but just more that just because people get really excited about arms control, the principle of national security at NSC level does not mean that they should be running it at all points in time.
I think that the one version of that, I mean, there's sort of the arms control of the bilateral arms reduction treaty variety, and then there's the counterproliferation efforts, like Corey was talking about, that are very different, right? And so, yes, the former is much more, can maybe be handled by the State Department and ISAC and within the professional expertise of those negotiators and the folks who are used to talking about verification regimes and warhead counting and all the ways you want to do that. It's this broader nonproliferation agenda that takes up a lot of time. And I think it's very interesting. I think that consensus, which is a weird term anyway, had probably frayed. And I think there'll be some very interesting conversations around that, especially around, you know, how much forward military intervention should you engage in order to prevent a state from getting potentially nuclear weapons? Unanswered question for both camps, I think.
And I think just like pulling back a little bit on this, as I was reflecting on like things to talk about and where I think we go, you know, I feel like a missing piece in some of where Katrina and Corey's conversations were coming from is we have this sort of degradation of both internal processes and external trust. And I mean, trust in the American people, trust in our allies, frankly, even trust in our adversaries in terms of like what kinds of agreements can we get to. And a lot of what we've talked about here are substantive issues that need to be handled. But to my mind, the sort of greatest issue that like we need to talk about and think about in 2021 and beyond, regardless of who's in power, is what does a meaningful process look like? And how does that process translate outside of the small number of people in the executive branch to rebuilding or building or enabling sort of trust? And I think a component of that has to be greater transparency about what's going on. And I don't see that as a conversation that's really being had at all. Like, what does it mean to have transparency in a national security process? What does it mean to have public accountability? What does it mean to have meaningful congressional oversight, and who provides that, and how are those people accountable to their constituents? And that's just a conversation that we probably should be having more earnestly now than we have or probably will have in the next coming weeks.
Rada, I want to have principals committee meetings that are like broadcast publicly, but I'm a little crazy. So there's probably interim steps before we get to that point.
I mean, that's definitely a side of this.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears again and talk a little bit about pop culture, but maybe broaden that to a little bit of self-care. This is likely to be a stressful week for any number of our listeners. I am not expecting there to be a significant amount of resolution on election night itself, and I think that's okay. I'm all in favor of counting the votes until all the votes are counted. So folks might need a break this week. What do we have to offer that might help folks get away, disengage, soothe their nerves, escape in some manner?
So it turns out that my birthday is election day, and also it's a pandemic. So I'm like really riding the self-care train this week. But I think, Erin, you have been saying this, and I think it's helpful, like a regular reminder that we're probably not going to know the answers on election night. That's okay. And like, we don't need to try to force it. And I think even like getting your head around that is really helpful for me to just like expectation manage. And while I'm doing that, I am rewatching Emily in Paris and sort of wishing that I was like 20 something and single, living a floor above a very attractive Frenchman and wearing fabulous clothes and shoes going out and about on the town. So
that Frenchman is very attractive.
I have been rereading the entire Tamora Pierce oeuvre, starting with the Becca Cooper books. I have now moved on to the Protector of the Small books. Mm-hmm. I'm saving the Alana books for inevitably I'll be awake at 2 a.m. on Tuesday and we'll need something to distract myself. So I'll do that.
So I think book saving is like a tried and true strategy. I've been saving the new Lady Sherlock book for election night.
Nice.
Because I was like, I'm going to need something that's like interesting enough that I want to keep reading it, but not like in any way connected to the modern world.
Yep. And that's exactly what this is. This is a books about young women who kick ass in various forms, have very empowered relationships when they do have relationships, have strong friendships, and also have decided that like they don't always need men all the time, or women as the case may be. So I've been doing that. My husband and I have been rewatching various very lighthearted comedy specials on Netflix. I highly recommend John Mulaney towards this end. I read the other day that self-care rings too much of like, are you doing your yoga? Are you drinking your water? Are you having tea? That like indulgence is also okay right now. So like you need to move beyond your daily practice of like whatever thing you're doing that's actually healthy, and you want to just like Uber Eats yourself up like a chocolate cream pie, then just do it.
I love that.
Yeah, I've been eating my feelings for several days now. It's getting a little dire. I have to say there needs to be an end point to that strategy for me at any rate. So I usually self-soothe with pop culture, as you guys know, and I have definitely struggled on that front lately. I am reading a pretty good British mystery of the Veronica Speedwell series. I will let you know if it sticks the landing. I'm almost done with it. I've watched assorted things on Netflix, but nothing has really super grabbed me. The Rice stuff on Disney Plus is pretty good, and in the vein of Attractive Frenchmen, has extremely attractive actors playing the astronauts, which is pretty entertaining. It's not even an update. I mean, just a retelling of the book, same as the movie, but in a more in-depth, serialized sort of form. And so it's actually quite engaging. The Mandalorian is out for folks who are interested in that part of the Star Wars universe. My brother and I are going to watch that on election night while we avoid some of the early prognostications. So I'm excited about that. I've also been doing so a different form of indulgence, but just like deep nesting in my own apartment. So I have three different like grow light stations for all the plants that I've brought inside. They're all legal. Everyone calm down. But there's just like, so there's a lot of like natural light and sort of, you know, full spectrum, visible light in my apartment right now. Lots of small, you know, the guest room, you know, has like perfect, you know, cabinets and lamps and, you know, sheets and whatnot. So, you know, I think there's a fair amount of self-soothing that can go on in terms of making your home space and workspace feel comfortable and soothing, which I would encourage. The thing I need to do better, and this current weather today is not helping, is exercise. Go outside, walk in nature, get, you know, just be out in some of the fresh air. And hopefully we have some opportunity to do that this coming week.
And if I can just, I really like the indulgence framing, because the thing I've been struggling with and a thing I think it's worth acknowledging about this election is that a lot of people don't feel it just as an important political and policy issue. They feel it as a personal impact, that their very like existence, their family's existence, their sort of life and ability to work are dependent on outcomes of the election. And in many cases, that is not an exaggeration. And I think like to the extent that like we have to kind of, the only way out is through here, things like indulgences, things like just kind of accepting that, you know, like maybe you're not going to go on a walk and like that's okay. And maybe you are going to Uber a cream pie, which I'm definitely going to figure out how to do, and that's okay. And I feel like just some basic kindness for yourself and people around you, and acknowledgement of the really harsh reality of what we're living through, I think is in order. And I myself have been trying to push myself and those I love in that dimension, because it is just hard. And I think it's just worth keeping that sort of close as you soothe, indulge, and or avoid with a variety of pop culture options.
Depending on your work environment, and actually, I mean, as much as you can in any work environment, I think it's also fair for people to be able to say, I'm struggling this week. I can't focus in this meeting, so I'm going to cancel it. Or this is just not going to get done today, so I will commit to getting it done for you tomorrow. And being open about that, as just opposed to suffering in silence, I think is also something that is occasionally worth engaging in. Not everybody can do that in their work environment. I have been abusing this privilege in my own. So,
well, and I think there's often an inclination to try to seem like, you know, world events don't, and external events don't impact you. And like, we're all automatons who can like leave external events and come in and optimize your functioning every day. And like, that's not a reasonable expectation for people, but it's also just like not helpful. So I agree, Lauren. I think to the extent you can acknowledge it, even if you can't cancel the meeting, just acknowledge it. It's worth doing.
And just two last bits there. I have been amused and surprised and, you know, warmed by what I call Bitmoji diplomacy, which is just finding the random Bitmojis or GIFs or whatever and sending them to your friends. They don't even have to say, like, it's not a question. They don't have to ask a question even. It's just an acknowledgement that you're thinking of them, that, you know, if you, that you want to reach out and, you know, you can, that can go somewhere or it can just sort of sit there. But I have found that to be both effective in reaching out to folks who I know are struggling, but also enjoyable for me to reach out to those folks and then have them reply. And lastly, I think a piece that we have all tried, at least variations of, whether it's the Calm app or Headspace, there actually are some very good kind of technological tools out there. I really like the Headspace app, which has these kind of SOS meditation practices, which are like 3 to 5 minutes, try to get you out of a nasty spiral. But they also have a bunch of like soundscapes and like animal videos and a variety of other things that are kind of useful for, again, trying to, you know, in the moment, soothe nerves and get people just a little bit more reset. So whatever you need to do, try not to find all of your answers in the bottom of the bottle. And, you know, hopefully we'll have some interesting foreign policy topics to discuss here when we're back in a couple weeks.